Welcome to the deep dive. You sent us some really thought-provoking material on sexual ethics, and that's exactly what we're diving into today. We've got a stack of perspectives here looking at what makes sexual conduct moral, the obligations involved, and, well, those varying viewpoints on homosexual relations.
It's fascinating stuff, and it touches on some deeply held beliefs.
Yeah.
Our goal in this deep dive is to really understand the core philosophical and theological values presented in this lecture on Christian ethics you shared.
Right.
We'll be unpacking ideas from thinkers like Bertrand Russell, Thomas Mabes drawing on Kant, and Roger Scruton with his Aristotelian approach, alongside the biblical perspectives. We want to get to the heart of their arguments, without getting sidetracked by the politically charged noise around these issues.
Okay, let's jump right in then with Bertrand Russell. Your material describes his views as pretty radical for the 1930s. It sounds like he had a very different take on things compared to the traditional norms of the time.
Absolutely. The core takeaway with Russell is this radical idea for his time. You need sexual experience before marriage to actually know if you're truly compatible with someone. It's a very practical, almost utilitarian perspective on a traditionally moral issue. He thought that without that physical knowledge, people might get married based solely on initial attraction, which, well, isn't a solid foundation for lifelong partnership.
So it was almost a case of needing to like road test the connection to see if it was the real deal beyond just initial feelings.
Yeah, basically.
And it wasn't just about premarital sex, right? He also advocated for making divorce much easier.
Exactly. He believed that if a marriage wasn't working for both people, they should be able to end it by mutual agreement. This was a significant departure from the much stricter divorce laws of that era, reflecting his emphasis on individual happiness and freedom within relationships.
And it sounds like he wasn't exactly a fan of traditional Christian views on sex, seeing them as rooted in things like societal modesty and even jealousy.
Well, if we connect this to his broader philosophical outlook, Russell was often critical of what he saw as outdated or, irrational social and religious rules that limited individual freedom. He felt these rules often came from negative emotions rather than well-reasoned ethical principles.
So if he was pushing back against these traditional ideas, what positive guidance did he offer for navigating sexual relationships? It sounds like he boiled it down to practicing basic human decency.
Yes, essentially. He concluded by emphasizing the importance of tolerance, kindness, truthfulness, and justice in our sexual interactions. It's a very secular, virtue-based approach, focusing on treating others with respect and honesty in this intimate area of life.
Which on the surface seems pretty reasonable, but it's interesting that your source material points out what's missing from that list from a Christian standpoint.
This raises an important question about the values that different ethical systems prioritize. The lecture notes specifically highlight the absence of virtues like purity and faithfulness in Russell's concluding thoughts. From a traditional Christian perspective, these are seen as crucial aspects of sexual morality that go beyond just general kindness and honesty.
Right, so a very different set of foundational values shaping the entire conversation. Okay, now shifting gears, let's look at Thomas Mabes and his Kantian approach. For anyone who needs a quick reminder, Kant's philosophy is heavily focused on duty and treating people with respect, not just as tools to get what we want.
Exactly. And Mabes takes Kant's famous idea of treating people as ends in themselves, not just tools to get what we want, and applies it very directly to sex.
Okay.
For him, the absolute bottom line of ethical sexual interaction is, did they truly freely say yes, understanding what they were agreeing to? If not, that's using them, which is a big no-no in Kantian ethics.
Okay, so it all comes down to consent, but it sounds like Mabes goes into detail about the ways that yes might not be truly free or fully informed.
Precisely. Mapes outlines two main ways consent can be undermined: coercion and deception. Coercion takes away the free part of consent, while deception messes with the informed part.
Can you give us some clearer examples of what he means by coercion and deception in a sexual context?
Sure. Think of it like this: a current coercion is outright force, like physical assault that's clearly not voluntary.
Right.
Dispositional coercion is more subtle, like using your power maybe as a boss or a teacher to pressure someone into sex by threatening their job or grades, or maybe offering rewards. Both take away their genuine choice.
That makes a lot of sense. It's not just about physical force, but also exploiting power dynamics. And how does deception factor in?
Deception, according to Mapes, involves lying or, importantly, leaving out important information that would reasonably influence someone's decision about having sex.
Okay.
Examples would be someone saying they're single when they're married, or not telling a partner they have HIV. These actions prevent the other person from making a truly informed decision about the risks involved, you know.
Got it. And it sounds like MAPES's framework has some pretty strong implications when it comes to things like sex with children or individuals with severe mental disabilities.
Absolutely. MAPES argues that sex with individuals who cannot legally or mentally give voluntary informed consent is inherently a violation of this Kantian principle. The lecture notes specifically point out how this would include a strong condemnation of groups like MBA, for instance, even if they claim consent was given.
Which is a really stark contrast, as the lecture notes point out, with Russell's ethic, which doesn't necessarily arrive at that same clear condemnation.
No, it doesn't seem to.
That's a pretty significant difference in how these ethical frameworks play out.
It really highlights how different foundational principles, even when both are concerned with avoiding harm or focusing on some aspect of consent, can lead to very different moral conclusions.
Now let's turn our attention to Roger Scruton and his approach, which is grounded in Aristotelian virtue ethics. It sounds like he offers a defense of a more traditional Christian view of sexual morality.
Yeah, what's fascinating here is how Scruton uses the idea of virtues, you know, character traits that contribute to human flourishing, to argue that sex is best expressed within the commitment of monogamous marriage. Mm. He sees erotic love as a virtue that enhances our well-being and happiness, but he believes its virtuous practice requires that monogamous commitment.
And what are his key reasons for linking erotic love, virtue, and this idea of one partner for life?
Well, Scruton argues that because erotic love is so deeply about union and vulnerability, it naturally brings with it the potential for jealousy.
Okay.
He believes that the public and solemn vow of marriage is crucial for building the trust and security needed to manage that jealousy and cultivate a stable, virtuous love. He also makes the point that sexual expression outside of this total commitment undermines its significance as an act that involves our whole selves.
I remember a bumper sticker mentioned in the notes. Is there sex after marriage? It sounds like Scruton would have a pretty strong opinion on that sentiment.
Absolutely. He would argue that the idea that marriage somehow stifles erotic passion is completely wrong. In fact, he believed that the security and mutual commitment of marriage actually provide the ideal conditions for both deep erotic love and a fulfilling sexual life.
And it's interesting that the lecture notes bring in some actual research findings that seem to support Scruton's perspective.
Yes. The notes mention surveys suggesting that people in monogamous relationships report higher levels of sexual satisfaction. There's even that intriguing study indicating higher rates of orgasm reported by women who identify as conservative Christians, which definitely challenges some common assumptions about sexuality and religious belief.
That's a surprising nugget of information, and it seems there's also data that pushes back against Russell's more permissive views on relationships.
Indeed. The notes point to research showing higher divorce rates among couples who live together before getting married. This suggests that cohabitation beforehand doesn't necessarily lead to greater marital stability. And the quotes from researchers Waite and Gallagher further support this, indicating that, on average, couples who cohabitate before marriage report lower levels of sexual faithfulness, less settled lives, and lower overall happiness and commitment compared to those who marry directly.
And then there's that quote from C.S. Lewis, which adds another layer to this, a more philosophical or maybe even spiritual perspective.
Yeah, what's powerful about Lewis's quote is his argument that sex outside of marriage is almost like trying to isolate one part of a whole. He describes it as a monstrosity because it attempts to separate the physical union from the deeper emotional, social, and even spiritual union that marriage is meant to encompass, ultimately leading to a fragmented experience.
So, moving away from these philosophical viewpoints, let's delve into what the source material presents as the biblical basis for monogamy and sexual purity.
Okay. The lecture emphasizes the foundational biblical view of marriage as a unique union between one man and one woman, pointing to the one flesh metaphor in Genesis, where Adam and Eve become a single entity. This isn't just a historical detail. Jesus himself refers vow to this passage in Matthew 19 when discussing divorce, reinforcing the idea of God's intention for a lifelong exclusive partnership.
And of course, the Ten Commandments are pretty clear on the issue of adultery.
Absolutely. The commandment against adultery is a cornerstone of biblical sexual ethics, clearly prohibiting sexual activity outside the marital commitment. Furthermore, the notes mention the Apostle Paul's powerful analogy of marriage as representing the relationship between Christ and the church, elevating the significance of marital fidelity to a profound spiritual level.
And this theme of sexual purity seems to run throughout the biblical texts.
It does. The lecture highlights the repeated emphasis on believers being members of Christ and temples of the Holy Spirit, which creates a strong call for sexual purity in thought and action.
Okay.
The analogy drawn between human procreation and the Trinity is also quite intriguing for considering the deeper meaning of human sexuality.
That parallel you mentioned, the Holy Spirit proceeding from the Father and Son, and a child coming from the union of a mother and father, sharing their human nature, it really makes you wonder if that's just a chance similarity or if it points to something more fundamental about the nature of relationships and creation.
Exactly. It invites us to consider whether this mirroring suggests a deeper metaphysical connection between human sexuality as intended and the very nature of the divine. It's quite profound when you think about it.
Okay, now we need to address the often sensitive topic of homosexuality. And it's interesting that your source material makes a clear distinction between attraction and practice.
This is a really crucial point. As the lecture notes based on Scott Ray's work emphasize, the term homosexual itself can be ambiguous. It might refer to someone who experiences primary or exclusive same-sex attraction, or it could describe someone who is engaged in same sexual behavior regardless of their underlying attractions.
Right.
Using more precise language like same-sex attracted helps to clarify the discussion, you know.
And when it comes to understanding the causes of homosexuality, it sounds like that's still an area with a lot of ongoing debate and not a lot of definitive answers.
Yeah, the lecture notes highlight that the question of whether same-sex attraction is primarily due to genetic factors, environmental influences, or a combination of both remains unresolved. While there have been neurobiological studies, the genetic research, particularly twin studies, has often been cited. However, even these studies haven't provided a clear-cut answer.
Can you break down some of the key findings from those twin studies for us?
Certainly. Early studies that suggested a 100% genetic link have been largely discredited due to methodological issues.
Okay.
More widely cited studies, like those by Bailey and Pillard, found that identical twins, who share all their genes, were more likely than non-identical twins to both identify as homosexual, suggesting a genetic component. However, the concordance rate for identical twins was still only around 50%. Meaning that even if one identical twin was same-sex attracted, the other wasn't always.
So, not deterministic.
Right. And more recent research has shown even lower concordance rates and has pointed to other potential factors, such as shared experiences between twins.
So, the overall picture seems to be that while genetics might play a role for some, it's definitely not the only factor at play.
That's the general consensus presented in the material, yes. The fact that not all identical twins share the same sexual orientation strongly suggests that non-genetic factors, including environmental influences and perhaps even individual choices, are also important in the development of sexual attraction.
Now, what about the ethical implications of these potential causes? Does it fundamentally change the moral discussion depending on whether someone is born that way or if their attractions develop later in life?
Well, the lecture argues that from an ethical perspective that respects the idea of free will, the underlying cause of same-sex attraction doesn't directly determine the morality of acting on that attraction.
Yeah.
Unless you believe in a strict form of determinism where all our choices are pre-programmed, individuals still have the capacity to make choices about their behavior, regardless of their inclinations. The analogy used is someone with a genetic predisposition to alcoholism still being responsible for whether or not they choose to drink.
So experiencing an attraction doesn't automatically make acting on that attraction either morally neutral or something someone is compelled to do.
That's the key ethical point being made. While acknowledging the reality and potential challenges of same-sex attraction, the lecture emphasizes the freedom individuals have in choosing how they respond to those attractions. It also underscores the importance of offering compassion and understanding to those who experience these attractions.
Okay, now we need to get into the biblical texts that are frequently discussed in relation to homosexuality, and it sounds like there's a range of interpretations of these passages.
Right. The lecture highlights several key biblical passages that are often cited in this discussion. The story of Sodom in Genesis 19, Leviticus 18 and 20, 1 Timothy 1:8-10, 1 Corinthians 6:9-11, and Romans 1. Each of these passages contains language that has been traditionally understood to condemn homosexual behavior.
Can you give us a brief overview of how each of these passages is typically interpreted?
Sure. The destruction of Sodom in Genesis 19 is often seen as a judgment on the city's wickedness, which is interpreted by some, based on later biblical references like Jude, to include homosexual acts.
Mm-hmm.
Leviticus 18 and 20 explicitly state that sexual relations between men are an abomination, and in the later passage prescribe the death penalty under that ancient law.
Okay.
In 1 Timothy 1 Corinthians, the term, often translated as homosexual offenders, is listed among various types of immoral people who will not inherit the kingdom of God. Romans 1 contains the most extensive discussion where Paul speaks of unnatural sexual relations between men and women, which has been widely interpreted as a condemnation of homosexual acts.
And it's particularly regarding Romans 1 that the lecture mentions some alternative interpretations.
Yes. So more recent interpretations of Romans 1 suggest that Paul might only be condemning specific forms of homosexual behavior, such as male prostitution, or perhaps that he's addressing heterosexual individuals engaging in homosexual acts, which would be unnatural for them, but not necessarily for those with a homosexual orientation.
I see.
Another interpretation posits that Paul is condemning exploitative or promiscuous homosexual behavior, not committed monogamous same-sex relationships.
But the lecture also presents the more traditional historical understanding of these texts.
Right. The traditional and historical interpretation, which the lecture aligns with, is that these passages, including Romans 1, are a general condemnation of all homosexual behavior, regardless of whether it involves financial exchange, aligns with someone's perceived natural inclination, or occurs within a committed relationship. This view holds that the alternative interpretations often involve imposing modern understandings onto ancient texts.
It sounds like the speaker in your source material finds the traditional interpretation to be the most straightforward reading of the biblical text.
That's the conclusion presented, yeah. Suggesting that the traditional interpretation is the one that arises most naturally from the text itself, without requiring significant additional assumptions or interpretations.
Finally, the lecture wraps up with some suggestions for further reading for anyone who wants to delve deeper into these complex issues.
Yes, the lecture recommends several books offering different perspectives. What is Marriage? Man and Woman? A Defense by Anderson, George, and Gurgis? Kevin DeYoung's What Does the Bible Really Teach About Homosexuality? Robert Gagnon's The Bible and Homosexual Practice? Texts and Hermeneutics, which is noted as a particularly comprehensive and scholarly work.
Okay.
Robert Riley's Making Gay.
Hmm.
Okay. How Rationalizing Homosexual Behavior is Changing Everything, described as a cultural analysis.
Yeah.
And Pope John Paul II's Theology of the Body, considered a very influential work on human sexuality from a Catholic perspective.
Right. I've heard of that one.
And Christopher West's Theology of the Body for Beginners is recommended as a more accessible entry point. The lecture also highlights the emphasis in theology of the body on understanding human sexuality in light of the Trinity.
So we've really journeyed through a wide range of ideas in this deep dive, looking at philosophical arguments, theological frameworks, and biblical viewpoints on sexual ethics in general, and the specific topic of homosexuality.
And as we said at the beginning, our goal has been to explore the ideas presented in the material you shared, trying to understand the different perspectives without endorsing any particular stance on these often very sensitive and debated issues.
So for you to consider as you continue to think about this, how might these different frameworks we've explored today, whether it's a focus on consequences, like with a more utilitarian view, on duty and universal principles, like with Kant, on character and flourishing, like with Scruton, or on divine revelation, how might these lead to different conclusions when you apply them to other contemporary ethical questions around sexuality that we didn't specifically touch on today?
Yeah, that's a good question.
What are the fundamental assumptions and values within each of these approaches that might drive those differing conclusions? It's definitely something to keep mulling over.